Good morning. Good morning. And good morning to you too. Happy New Year. Happy New Beginning. We have another chance to get it right. Every day we wake up, it's another opportunity to try to make it better. Try to make ourselves better individually. Try to help our families rise to another level. Try to preserve, protect, and expand our communities and grow a country into the ideal of itself when it trips over its identity. This is Law of the Land, and I'm Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I'm excited and just a little nervous about the topic we're going to expand on, because for many people in communities of color, in particular the African-American community, property, the issue of property, is a deep and dividing one. Property, we think of from the very beginning of this country, those who had land could vote in the colonial days. And of course, land then became, even in New York State with its slavery, those who were free had to have land in order to be African American and vote, where those people who were white, they found if they were going to get that poor white vote, they could not have land as a requirement, or they couldn't get that vote. And so they took away the land requirement for whites and kept the land requirements for African Americans. And John Brown, yes, the abolitionist John Brown and others bought land in the Adirondacks and then gave that land for very minimal cost to African men so that they could have the land requirement in order to vote. And then when we got, of course, into the 1800s, when Black men gained the right to vote through the 15th Amendment in 1870, women in 1920 with the 19th Amendment. And of course, the entire time there was a backlash around that right to vote that was no longer attached to the ownership of property, but then became the issue of segregated neighborhoods under Jim Crow and the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896 that we saw in full effect and still living with the vestiges or remnants, ramifications of tradition of segregation in property. There used to be, they said, if you rode the bus in New York City and each time you stopped in a particular neighborhood going closer to Harlem, you would see the bus darken as the white folks would get out. And there would be brown and black people left over going into Harlem. Now it changes somewhat, but you can still ride the subway and the buses, and you begin to see, based on who's left on the subway and the bus, what neighborhoods you've passed through and what neighborhoods you're going to. But when you get to other places in the South, across the country, my hometown and the hometown of so many others, you'll find that at the heart of the segregation is also this idea of elitism and what progress is. And what do I mean by that? What happens in most communities? You see European immigrants come in, other immigrants come in, they work, you know, the lower level jobs, they try as hard as they can to get a foothold in the economy. So they have to live in disparate means and places. And then as they get money, they grow and then prosper and then leave and start other communities. That's why Little Italy is not Little Italy anymore. If you have a chance to go over Little Italy, it's like there are very few Italians there. There are many Europeans, many of them not Italians, a lot of Latinos and others trying to pass for Italian. But a lot of the Italians moved to New Jersey, or, you know, you saw a lot of the Jewish communities from the Lower East Side moved out to Queens and moved into the suburbs of Westchester. People do that, except in the African-American community has been so confined by laws and prejudices and restrictions that many times even the middle-class community was not able to leave. So when it stayed, you would think that it could have its place of pride, a home that it could cherish and pass on to its children. This show is going to talk about the fact that even those communities were attacked by eminent domain. Eminent domain. This happened in Brooklyn. I saw it myself when I lived there, when they decided to build what is now the Barclays Stadium. Those were homes that were taken by eminent domain. I have to confess, as a professor at John Jay College, the new building, we call it, we haven't named it yet. We haven't gotten somebody who's got enough money to put their name on the building. So we still call it the new building. That was a parking garage. I remember it clearly. I parked there and they took it by eminent domain. Eminent domain is within the constitutional powers of the government, state, local, and federal, to take private property. It's under the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. It's almost like this clause that was slapped on to the Fifth Amendment because it doesn't fit in anything else that's in the Fifth Amendment. We know the Fifth Amendment, people take the Fifth if they don't have to speak to, you know, incriminate themselves, but the Fifth Amendment has on the last line, quote, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. What is compensation that's just? Well, it depends on who's in power at the time. It's always been, for the most part, those people who didn't look like the folks who were having their property taken who decided what compensation would be just, would be equitable. Private property, that means someone's private home or business taken by state, local, federal government for public use. And this private property taken for public use and this provision of the Constitution within the Fifth Amendment is referred to as the Takings Clause, because the private property is being taken. And so it's the Takings Clause of the Constitution in the Fifth Amendment, the last line. In my book, Race, Law, and American Society, I have a chapter on property, because property, shelter, is basic to all of us. Shelter is one of the primary things outside of food and water that each one of us as human beings will need at some point in our lives. Even if we live in the most tropical of environments, when it rains, we still need to take shelter. This shelter is also, of course, part of what in many societies becomes the determining factor in wealth. How much do you have? What do you acquire? What have you acquired? And you see it in property. That white picket fence, they talk about the American dream of owning a home. It's sometimes very interesting, especially when I go out to the Bronx or Queens and I see these Mac mansions. You know, my listeners in the Bronx and Queens, the Mac mansions, people come over and it's like that American dream. I might only have a sliver of land, but I'm going to make my Mac mansion statement that this is my American dream. This property is my American dream. I had a chance to actually talk with Gay Talese, the prolific author, Gay Talese, and he talks about Bartleby and how Bartleby the Scrivener in Melville's short story was one person, a fictional character that he uses as a basis for his most recent book. And in that book, a gentleman blows himself up on the Upper East Side. Those Upper East Side people, remember when he blew himself up within the building of his townhouse because he did not want in a divorce to sell it and have to divide the proceeds. Dr. Bartha on 34 East 62nd Street blew up the building with himself inside because he said that was his American dream and to sell it was worse than death. And so he actually blew himself up in a gas fire and died within the building. That is what property means to so many people. Why is it so important to us right now? Because eminent domain has been used in a racialized, weaponized way to undermine Black communities. And today, our guest is going to talk to us about the particular community in her life in Newport News, Virginia. But I know it's in my life. I know it's in the life of Michael G., my engineer, and so many people of African descent, and not just in this country, but around the world, how state, local, and federal governments come in and take over using whatever law they have at their whim, the land of others, the same way the federal government took away the land of the indigenous. This whole idea that the government can take it away for some better purpose, some purpose that's beyond the purpose of the life, blood, dreams, and hopes, and financial foundation of those living there, taken away to use for their purposes that are always thought to be better than people of color, better than the immigrant's purpose, better than the purpose of someone they believe is politically not powerful enough to maintain their own property. So after this musical break, we'll be back to discuss eminent domain and the taking of Black land, Black neighborhoods by colleges and universities. Yes, Columbia University, New York University. So many of these universities come in and based on what the law allows them to do, they take over private property, our homes in particular, the homes of people of color and African Americans, in order to expand these college campuses. We watched them do it here in New York City. We watched them do it in New Jersey. Watch them do it in Connecticut. Watch them do it in Philadelphia, around the country. These colleges and universities expanded their campuses, and many of the communities around those campuses were middle-class Black communities. Let's discuss it further.
I am here with Brandi Kellum, and you are a reporter, an award-winning journalist, and someone who is personally also affected by this issue of eminent domain. I want you to first, if you would, tell us about the story, many of the stories that you've written around this issue.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I started working on researching eminent domain and stories like this over the last 2 or 3 years. And I am from the area in which the story that we're discussing today is located. And I've been looking into this issue because, as you mentioned in your intro, Black wealth has been a topic of discussion a lot in our country lately. And part of that is due to the fact that wealth building comes from being able to have a home, being able to have a right to property. And that's what got me interested in this. And so most of the stories that I have covered have been about how the loss of property has impacted the ability for Blacks to build wealth today.
And as an award-winning journalist, many times in journalism, they tell you that you're supposed to have this objectivity when it comes to the topic of your work. But this one struck home, and tell me how this came about.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not too far from where this area that I have researched and investigated recently is. I would say I grew up in the area, not too far away from where the community that we're discussing was essentially displaced and erased. And so I had, grown up knowing that the college, Christopher Newport University, is the college that was ultimately the vehicle used to displace this particular community. But growing up, I had no idea that that was the case. I frequented the college because I ran track in high school, and that was one of the areas where we would compete. And I had no idea that ultimately I was running on land that had been essentially from a large group of Black people in the 1960s, and over time, that ultimately led to the displacement of the entire community. community. So once I found that out, I became very much interested in learning more about this story and speaking to the families that have been impacted. And as I started to get to know the families a little bit more, I was just really blown away by what at least one family had done to try to preserve whatever memory of the community was left. You know, today there are only five houses left, but Mr. Johnson, who's a key figure in our story, and really is the reason why this is even, we were even able to tell the story this way, has just collected over 60 years, organized and collected over 60 years worth of documentation, right? Like photos, deeds, civil engineering maps showing that his family wanted to develop some of the land into middle class, into a middle class community. And so when I saw that, I was just, I was really completely blown away and moved by that. And I felt like this is something that more people should see.
And because this was so moving, there is an actual documentary film that's connected with it. And we're going to play an excerpt of that documentary, the title Uprooted, What a Black Community Lost When a Virginia University Grew. And we're going to play just a short excerpt of that right now and then continue with our interview.
Which aids them in their search for land to take.
The major policy and fulcrum that we have to focus on here is the Federal Housing Act of 1949. In 1959, that act was amended because a group of 14 plus colleges and universities made the appeal to the federal government. What this program did is that it provided a 2-to-1 federal matching grant. So two federal dollars for every $1 invested by the city into an urban renewal project if it was tied to a college or university. 2-to-1. Cities flocked to their local schools to come together to create these partnerships to build our urban renewal projects. But many times the neighborhoods that were deemed blighted were actually black middle class. So these neighborhoods were the ones targeted to enact eminent domain, which then allowed the city or government or the state to come in and in this new arrangement, it was black communities that were sacrificed at the altar of prosperity.
And so I'm here on WBAI with Brandy Kellum discussing this issue of eminent domain, the expansion of university and college campuses, and that expansion then undermining the progress of black communities. So when they're talking about progress, Brandy Kellum, whose progress are they discussing here?
That's an interesting question. And the progress here, so urban renewal, I heard the clip you played, urban renewal essentially was a way to create, the government was using this as a way to create progress, right, in these communities that they deemed needed government assistance to look better. Like that's like plain language, and the terms that were used to target these communities were blighted. That was the key term that was used there. And so that clip essentially is saying, what that clip essentially is pointing out to DeVarian Baldwin, is one of the experts that we interviewed for the documentary. He's essentially saying that these communities that were deemed blighted, or is for lack of a better word, unable to thrive without government assistance, were actually middle-class communities that were thriving on their own at the time. And these urban renewal projects that were deemed, you know, would be for the betterment of everyone as a whole, actually targeted more communities of color, more black communities than any other community, you know, in this country. And urban renewal, just to give you a picture of what we're looking at here, you know, it displaced hundreds of thousands of families over a 10-year period between like 1955 and 1965. But most of those communities were black communities. So when you ask about the progress that is, who is actually benefiting from that progress, if you look at that stat, it certainly wasn't the hundreds of thousands of Black families that were displaced or communities that were targeted, who were looked at as blighted, but actually were surviving communities.
And who the person or the people who would be the benefactors of that. And so the college campuses began to expand. But Brandy, tell me, when they began to expand, what was the just compensation that was given to these Black communities?
Yeah, so the compensation was, the communities were actually given compensation that was lower than what the property was worth. And speaking specifically to the Newport News community that was off of Shoe Lane, which is now pretty much gone. Now you have five houses left, and Christopher Newport College, Christopher Newport University is the university that sits in its place today. The families that were there before the college was placed there did not get the full value of their property when they were forced to move. We have documentation of that where the city in Newport News, actually the city council at the time who was deciding on which land to take for the college, went through three layers or levels of appraisal before they decided on one they felt like was most fitting for that particular community. So in that particular case, the families did not receive the full value of their land, and they were also displaced and forced to relocate. And we know that historically that is not just the case in Newport News. There are communities across the country that have experienced that same scenario. So you have, at the height of urban renewal, hundreds and thousands of Black families being displaced without getting the full value of what their home is worth, and then having to set up somewhere else and try to make do with whatever they could salvage from whatever they got from the cities that displaced them.
And what we've known is that property rises in value. And so holding on to that property would mean that it would have risen in value, and it would have given them even more of a financial stake and foothold in the economy today. As we see, years later, properties have tripled, quadrupled in value. The U.S. Supreme Court, in the case of Berman versus Parker in 1954, was a case in which Washington, D.C. land was taken, called blighted, and urban renewal, which has been referred to as Negro removal by James Baldwin and many others, was used to take a store in Washington, D.C. that was not owned by an African-American, but actually owned by a Jewish-American. And this is a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what is so important about this is that this foothold of urban renewal, people think is just going to be people of color. But once that ball of injustice starts rolling, it's going to roll over other communities as well. And so we even get to a 2005 case, and the reason why I'm saying this is because this is my area, a 2005 case of Kelo versus the city of New London in Connecticut, when once again these are white communities, New Jersey, white communities of working class, lower middle class communities that have also been taken over by eminent domain for the public good. So I want our listeners to know that although you're listening to stories of my communities in Kansas City where a highway was put through a middle class Black community I grew up in, and it could start with us, but the ball of injustice is going to continue to roll, gain speed and power, and roll over other communities as well, as I've indicated in these two U.S. Supreme Court cases. I want to go to one other issue we have here, and I know there's so many parts of this we can discuss, and that is the outcome. You said now there are just a handful of homes left from what used to be dozens of homes in a Black middle-class community as the college campus expands. I want to play another excerpt from this documentary titled Uprooted, What a Black Community Lost When a Virginia University Grew. And we're going to play this other very short excerpt, and then I want to bring you back, Brandy, to talk about the consequences of eminent domain when it comes to communities of color or communities that might not be as politically powerful to fight City Hall and the money behind the expansion of these universities. Just a moment. We'll be right back.
It was neighborhoods that just disappeared and no record of it. When there are other communities in other parts of the city, and their kids can stay generation after generation. Well, that's what my grandfather had in mind for us. And many of my neighbors, my generation, they didn't have that opportunity. But the property was here, they could have, if it hadn't been taken away through eminent domain. I did pictures of all the homes in the neighborhood. That helped me to get through that phase where the homes were going to disappear. And people would never know that we had a neighborhood that people loved each other and they were neighbors. I mean, just not just neighbors, they were friends, close-knit. And that's why I documented it. All that was going away, that was memory I wanted to have. It helped me to get through the pain of losing my buddies who I grew up with. Forced away.
I have to look at the school as an entity by itself. And the school is the center of cultural and educational activities in the community. And I think it enhances the community. There's always a price for progress. And sometimes people feel hurt by the progress. And I can accept that that is part of this progress. But I think on the whole, the pendulum swings towards positive.
So we're speaking with Brandi Kellum, who's an investigative journalist whose award-winning articles have appeared in so many places, and she's been associated with CBS News. And we accessed Brandi Kellum through ProPublica. And if you have a chance to read their amazing stories, ProPublica is the entity that broke the story on Clarence Thomas and Justice Alito taking amazingly expensive trips, et cetera. So it's an amazing news source. But I want to go back to something that was said here in this documentary, Uprooted, What a Black Community Lost When a Virginia University Grew. It appears from even looking back on what the university did in uprooting a middle-class black family, using devious political means to take their land, and then undercutting the amount of money, the so-called just compensation. It seems they haven't learned anything.
Hmm. Yeah, I would say that there's still, in the eyes of the people who were displaced, more that can be done. You know, talking to the families, and reliving this because, you know, this happened over a period of 60 years. You know, the key thing to this story was a lot of the communities that a lot of people believe or may believe that because all these things happened during the 1950s or 60s, that essentially the damage was done and that we've moved on from the bulk of what this injustice was to these families and communities that occurred during that time period. But we also know that because of generational wealth, the legacy of these types of takings during the 1950s and 60s still lives on in these communities or lack of communities today. And I think that the families that have experiences are looking for some sort of recognition, at least better than what has been done in their eyes by the college and the city of Newport News. And, you know, we're still looking at what's going to be done because of this. We know that there have been calls for legislation to look into this more in the state of Virginia. So we're just keeping our eyes open on that. But, you know, just to answer your question, I think that, you know, the families, I think they do feel like there's more that could be done and are looking to see what will be done because of this, the legacy of these takings in the 1950s and 60s and how it's played out over the last 60 years since then to where you now see just five houses left in a community that once had, you know, almost 100, over 100 families living there.
But But this is continuing. I mean, here in New York City, the expansion of New York University, expansion of Columbia, expansion of so many of these schools, this is continuing. It hasn't ended. And so
You're right.
So I'm looking at what are the lessons learned? It doesn't seem to be any lessons learned from the experiences. And maybe the lesson once again is we had the political will to do this and the amount of money to take these homes, and they don't seem to be able to be stopped. Is it that legislation that was mentioned from 1949 needs to be amended in some way that will then, you know, curtail the taking and the abuse of the taking of the homes of people of color and surrounding communities?
I think that because of the structure of eminent domain law in our country, it would probably take a lot of states looking at their laws, and I think some have. In 2005, you mentioned the Kelo decision, and that was essentially what opened up the gates for more eminent domain takings, right? And so some states responded to that by enacting their own laws that would help protect the property owner more. But we've talked to eminent domain experts that do say that there's more that can be done. Even though some of the reform has occurred in states individually or individual levels, that there's more that could be done to protect the property owner, especially communities of color where they don't have the resources to essentially fight for just compensation. You know, the families in the Shoe Lane community, and over a period of time, essentially just saw the writing on the wall, right? You know, they saw the power in play, the power structure in play, and realized that, they were going to give a good fight, but ultimately it was a losing battle for them. And the lesson learned in this particular story is, one, I think that this was a middle class community, right? So this was a community that was targeted for racism. Racism was the underlying reason for why this community was targeted. And so I think that that's one lesson that can be learned. And I think that our story also shows how these families are not only targeted, but they weren't given the fair compensation for their property. So one thing that I think people are looking at is what can be done to address those previous harms. And then looking forward, I think there are still lessons to be learned and still reforms to be made based on, you know, what we're hearing from eminent domain attorneys, from eminent domain attorneys to property owners, right? That they would like to see more protections in place so that communities of color aren't continuing to suffer the brunt of eminent domain taking.
And for those politicians, and we always have politicians, we have lawyers, we have so many different people who are listening to our program, what we need to do is to make sure our politicians are actually in the forefront of alerting communities that their homes could be in jeopardy. And as Columbia University, for one, Columbia University in New York City, you may know, is located, used to be located what was considered Harlem. But as Columbia University expanded, of course, they always changed the names of the community because then they don't want it to be associated with whatever the black community was before or whatever the community of color was. And they have to change it to their own name. And you see this happening in Brooklyn and so many other places here, where these communities have now been overtaken, overrun by residential apartment high-rises or, in this case, universities. And these universities and members of the staff in other places, as was stated by the gentleman speaking in the documentary, they believe that this is progress for the greater good of, I guess, the students of white America, of the city, in their balance, and when in your research, and this, and I know you must go, but in your research, what is the positive part that they believe outweighs taking someone's private home, that they believe in their minds the expansion of this school is necessary? Is it because it adds to the coffers, the financial coffers of the school? I mean, what is the argument that's being made, or are they making any argument when they take these homes of private people and others who had worked so hard to acquire them?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. From our reporting, what we found is that publicly city officials said that having a college in this location would benefit everyone, that not only would it benefit the people living, it would benefit the entire city of Newport News, not just, you know, a small group of people. But ultimately, you know, we look at the demographic of the college today, and the Black student population there is only 7%. The white student population is 75%. And since 1996, the Black student population has been declining. So it was higher at one point, and now it's just about 7 or 8%. So to answer your question about progress, what was said to those families, those Black families at the time in the 1950s who went to city council meetings and pleaded with the all-white city council not to choose that community to put the college there, what was said to them was that they would also benefit from it too. But as we can see, just based on the numbers alone, that Black students are not attending the college like I guess they thought that the city council members thought that they would when they said that everyone would be able to benefit from this when they decided to take this property during that time period.
And so what would you leave us with when it comes to eminent domain? What homework would you give us for those people who have properties close to colleges and universities and other places where they could use the takings clause to take those properties as these colleges and universities choose to expand, and I believe fill their economic coffers because it makes the college more, you know, viable economically to own property. Because colleges in so many places are the major employer and major property holders in many communities. And so what do you have to say, I guess, for those listeners who are saying, well, then how do we fight this?
Yeah, so one, I would say a lot of times when we found that when people, by the time people find out that their property is being taken by eminent domain, they're already fighting an uphill battle. So as depending on the situation, I think, one, it is one that is very difficult to fight on your own. And even though there is financing involved with getting representation, there are attorneys out there who work with people to help them get as best compensation for their property as possible. I think that it would be, based on our research and reporting, more likely to fight for the fair compensation than the fight for not taking the property at all. And that is something that is in the Constitution, that is in the Fifth Amendment, that property, government can take property for public use. So, you know, the argument that whether public use for a college or a university still is considered a public use for all, you know, that's something that I think is left, remains to be debated in legislative chambers or at the Supreme Court level. But for the homeowner who gets a knock on their door and finds out that their property is going to be taken by eminent domain, I think the best course of action, based on our reporting, is to get representation. And I think the other thing we learned in our reporting is that it's difficult to understand the overall impact that this can have if everyone's operating in a silo. So one of the things that was, even though the Shoerang community didn't necessarily win overall, they always were collective in terms of their fight against properties being taken. And I think that's kind of benefited them in some ways only because we know this story, right? I think as a collective, as an individual, they had not come together, I don't think we would know the impact of what this meant and how significant this loss was to that community. So those would be my two things, my two takeaways from the reporting that I learned. One is eminent domain is in the Constitution, and it is difficult to fight without representation. especially when you are community, you are a person who identifies as a person of color. And because those communities are seen as most likely to be taken because of the property values in those communities, right? So knowing and understanding what's happening around your community is one way to possibly get ahead of it, by learning what business interests that your city has or interests that your college has or plans your college has to expand. But ultimately, if the city decides to give the college the vehicle, if the college decides, the college has this vehicle to take your property by eminent domain, your best course of action is to get representation based on the research and reporting that we've seen. And then also, if it's an entire community, to know what's happening with your neighbors as well, so that there's some sort of collective effort if you all are looking to not be taken by eminent domain, to have more leverage. That's what we've learned from our reporting.
Thank you. And I would just add, as you go forward, that there is a need for lawyers who specialize in this, because it's a special, unique area to fight eminent domain cases. And that just as we saw in criminal cases and in policing cases and in other cases of housing discrimination, I think there also needs to be class action lawsuits that are discussed and litigation strategies created around a pattern of practice of governmental entities, state, local, and federal, using race-based strategies to undermine Black communities. I think this is another area that's ripe for a class action suit around pattern practice of racism when it comes to Black communities in eminent domain. And I have not seen that. And I think if those people who are listening, and I think if you can, Brandi Kellum, think about the need for class action lawsuits, because this is happening across the country. I thank you so much for joining me, and I hope you can return as you work on other stories.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And if your listeners would like to reach out to me, if they look for the story online, they'll see my contact information at the bottom. If there are other stories that are out there that are seeking to be told, you know, feel free to reach out to me. I'm happy to look into it.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And as we've said before, Brandi Kellum is an investigative journalist. He's the award-winning reporter, and the documentary Uprooted, What a Black Community Lost When a Virginia University Grew, is available online, as well as the many articles that she has written. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and we've been discussing eminent domain, the taking of properties, private properties by state, local, and federal government, and in particular, universities and colleges taking these properties and expanding college campuses. And yes, they may be beautiful campuses, but at what price? And as was pointed out, who is attending these colleges? The generational wealth that is lost when someone's home is taken is incalculable. And what we're finding is these takings of homes and the takings clause, the taking of homes for public use. The public use has a race-based component to it, that the way they decide what communities they're going to take over has a race-based component to it, or an eminent domain that is focused on those particular immigrant groups that may not be as politically powerful. And it's so often the issue of whose land will be taken is had and discussed between those people in the know in politics behind closed doors. And my concern is there are far too many women, immigrants, families of immigrants, people of color who are in that room who have chosen not to divulge this information to the communities who voted for them in the first place. That is despicable. And I am quite tired. And as we go into an election year, I am quite tired of those people of color, those people of immigrant communities, those women, and whomever those people have decided as a platform to use to get into these offices. being in the rooms with the powers that be and keeping these vital information, vital things to themselves without telling the communities. There has to be more communication between our elected officials and our communities. And if those elected officials are not communicating what's going on in places of government with the communities, they need to be gone. Gone. And I am very clear. And I've actually, when I interact with people in politics, I make sure it's very clear. If you're so busy, you can't come back to your community and let your community know what is going on, then you're too busy to be in the job. And I'm too busy to vote for you. So as we go through, eminent domain, taking homes, as I began by saying, is a personal issue for me. And I know it is for so many listeners. This is Law of the Land. Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Happy New Year as we start off fighting. But also take very good care of yourself, because this 2024 is going to be a wild ride. And as we go through the ups and downs of the political situation, the economic situation, the racial and everything else, every other ism situation that's going to come up out of this election year, we know it's going to be ugly. Just keep in mind, take care of yourself and know that you have the power to make a difference. And thank you, Michael G, for everything. This was a show, but I thank you all. And I am just so proud to be a part of the WBAI family. Thank you so much for supporting WBAI and supporting Law of the Land. Become a BAI buddy. And I'll see you on the radio.